Grandpa Herman didn't decide what to do with Ben Harback for 40 days, which Grandpa said was a sign. When he came out of the mysterious cellar that I couldn't even find on the property, he looked like a rib, having eaten nothing except rice for so many days, and the sunlight hurt his eyes so bad that he squinted almost all the time. I figured that by that time, Corinthian had forgotten him for sure, and it made me ill. We were already gathering tobacco, walking row after row and popping off the 4 leaves on the bottom of every plant, so that by the time we got back to that particular field, the higher leaves would have grown. The day after Ben Harback re-emerged, he was in the fields, but he was so weak that he fell behind, and Mustard had to help him keep up. James had moved on to bigger things than cropping tobacco by that time. He was driving the tractor, pulling the wooden drag where we tossed the leaves behind him. "You okay, Ben?" I asked him that afternoon. Because he hadn't been in the sun all summer, his skin was pale as a cotton bowl and not as absorbent. He was already lobstering in that heat.
"I'll be all right, I reckon," he said.
"'Cause you can sit on that drag if you ain't feeling good. Me and Mustard will cover for you, and James won't tell."
"I'll make do," he insisted.
He'd been underground so long that his voice sounded funny, like he had water in his lungs, and when James stopped at the end of a row to wait for us to crop the last few leaves and then turn the tractor around to go back down the next, I stopped him. "Ben's sick," I told him.
"Why do you say that?"
"Look at him. He's about to fall down."
"It'll be okay," James said, and drove on, riding high, like king of the field.
We took a break in the middle of the afternoon, and Ben climbed weakly onto the drag with the rest of us, and James drove us back to the barn where a bunch of women were putting the tobacco leaves onto the conveyor belt, and Nana was straightening them before they went through the stringer, where they got stitched to the old wooden sticks. During summer, we were allowed to drink Coca-Colas in bottles and eat Neckets out of their plastic wrappers on breaks. It was the only relief we got from the sun and the work. We took 20 minutes to catch our breath. Even the men who were hanging the sticks in the barn got to come out and talk.
"You all right, Ben?"
Nana asked him.
"Yeah, I'm fine," he said.
"We're glad to have you back with us," David added.
"Glad to be here," Ben said. "It's been lonely down under. I reckon I shouldn't say that, since I had God to converse with. But I missed you people."
"We missed you too," Daddy said. Before we left to go back to the fields where the strong people worked, where James drove a tractor and David did, where all the older children worked, cropping tobacco, and the younger ones followed them, picking up dropped leaves, and the littlest ones, not even old enough for school, sat at the edges of rows and played with their toy tractors. I pulled Nana aside and said, "Ben Harback's gonna pass out."
"You reckon?"
Nana asked. "He's pale, and he can't keep up, and he needs to go to bed."
"I told Herman not to put him in this field before he got a good meal," she said, walking back.
Nana motioned Ben to the side of the barn and was talking with him when Grandpa Herman drove up in his shiny pickup and Ben hurried back to rejoin the croppers. We went back out in the sun, plucking off our leaves and laying them onto the drags in big armfuls. We hadn't been working long before Ben threw up. I heard him gagging and didn't want to look, but I didn't want him to get in trouble by falling behind, so I kept crossing over to his row, and Mustard helped too, while Ben choked and wiped his face.
"I can do it," Ben panted after a few minutes. "Y'all get back to your rows. I'll get mine."
"It's okay," Mustard tried. "Take it easy."
"I can do it," he bellowed. "Leave me alone."
He leaned over, cropped a handful of leaves, and tossed them on the drag next to the ones I'd just put there. A clump of vomit fell off his shirt and landed on the trailer. I had to talk myself out of getting sick.
I had to force myself not to think about it. Me and Mustard let him keep going, and I prayed for my own weak stomach instead of for Ben. We were halfway down the next set of rows when Mustard hollered out, "Hey, Ben's fell down!" James didn't hear him and kept driving slowly along. "Hey," Mustard called again, "Ben's down!" I ran over to Ben, and some others rustled through tobacco stalks to where he'd collapsed. Somebody stopped James, and he turned off the tractor. "He ain't hardly breathing," Pammy declared. "He's breathing," I said. "Don't exaggerate." But I was worried. His face was sunburned to the point that it looked like you could wipe his skin off with your fingers. But beneath that redness, it seemed like the blood had drained away. It was the scariest color I'd seen, doughy pink and almost runny. "Let's get him up there," Barley said, and picked Ben up from under the arms. Mustard got his legs. We all hopped onto the drag, trying to balance our weight in the middle so that it didn't tip up or down, and Mustard sat up on the tractor's tire shield to keep it from being so heavy. I wiped at Ben's face with a tobacco leaf. It was all I had. James drove back to the barn, going so fast that the nickels and dimes in the engine sounded like steady quarters. Dust clouded around us as we hit bumps in the road. Dust particles muddied in our sweat. "Slap him, Nina," Pammy said. "Wake him up." So I did. I hit him on both sides of the face, and then once really hard in the middle of the chest, all the time asking God to preserve him. "Ben!" Pammy shouted. "Ben!" She yelled it in my ear, but I didn't fuss. When we got to the barn, Nana ran over to us, and Grandpa Herman pulled the truck up, and Everett and Olin lifted the still unconscious Ben into the back. Nana leaped in, and then Grandpa drove away. "Get back to work," David said. "Everybody back in the fields." So we went. James asked me if I thought Ben would be okay, and I said I hoped so. James asked me where he was staying, and I told him that I figured he was in Nana's spare bedroom. James asked me if I thought God was punishing Ben, and I told him that God didn't need to, because Grandpa Herman took care of that better than anybody else I knew. "Sometimes when you say things like that, I wonder how God would even be willing to speak through you," James smarted. "Well, it's the truth," I said. "Leaving a man in a cellar for 40 days, I don't see how you could call it anything else but cruel." We were out behind the barn. James and Barley and Mustard were in charge of watching the fires that burned beneath the leaves, making sure they didn't get too hot and ignite the curing tobacco during the night. Because James was still working, I got to go outside for prayer partners. Nobody was concerned about it. Barley and Mustard were there too, but they'd fallen asleep already, in the soft sand beneath the shed, where the tobacco stringer was parked next to the barn door. And we were on the far side of the barn, closest to the woods, stretched out on our backs and looking up at dark sky, pocked with clouds. We couldn't even see the moon. "Do you ever worry that what we do sometimes during prayers could be considered fornicating?" James asked. "No," I lied. "What we're doing is different. It's just a part of a prayer. Besides, it isn't you I'm doing it with. It's Jesus." "Yeah. I don't think we should mention it to anybody, though," I added. "No," James agreed. "They wouldn't understand. Sometimes I worry that we're fornicating, though." I felt an awful pinching in my stomach when he said that. I knew that if James really started believing he was sinning, he'd tell. I didn't know what Grandpa'd do to us if he found out. I suspected it would be far worse than anything that had happened to Ben, since Ben came into the community late in life, but we'd grown up there. "What Ben did is different," James coaxed himself. "That's nothing like what we do." "No, I mean, if Ben had been following God's instructions, he wouldn't never have gotten caught. Do you think? No, I said again. Me neither. I rolled over onto my side then, facing James, and I put my hand on his shirt and ran my fingers along the middle of his chest. He was skinny. We both were. But if you're Jesus to me, James figured, then when I'm loving Jesus through you, that means I'm really loving a man. Do you reckon that makes me, you know, funny? Jesus ain't a man, I giggled quietly. He's a spirit. He's a God. That's not anything like loving a man. You're right, James said, rolling over to face me. And then I flattened back, out on my back. He ran his hands across my abdomen, across those bones that poked up at the place where my hips began. They feel like noses, James whispered. If you're really worried about it, I said quietly, my voice getting lower and earthing, then maybe we should ask Jesus for a sign. What kind of sign? I don't know. We could pray about it and see what happens. So we prayed together, then quietly alone, and the whole time I was scurrying through my mind, trying to think of a way to make James certain that what we were doing wasn't a sin. Finally, I thought of something that might work. Lord, I said aloud, I think you're trying to give me something for James. I'm not sure what it is yet, so please make it clear to me. Thank you, Jesus, for speaking to Nina, James prayed. The ring? I pretended to ask God. You want me to put the ring on his finger? What ring? James muttered. Look, I said to him with as much sincerity as I could muster. Jesus gave me a ring for you to put on your finger. He's marrying us, James. I took his hand in mine, reached for his middle finger, and then slipped the invisible ring down over the knuckle. Can you feel it? I asked him. It's gold with little diamonds all around. I can feel it, James laughed, and then he started crying. Oh, God, Nina, can you believe it? Wait, I have to ask God if there's something for you. While he prayed, I felt low and wicked, and I expected at any minute to hear a trumpet in the sky, God calling his children home, to get them away from someone as evil as me. I felt lower than river sludge, but I wasn't about to back down. Thank you, Christ, James said. Thank you for your sign. What'd he say? I asked. He gave me a ring for you, too. Give me your hand. And he worked his fingers down mine, pausing for a second, then pushing until he fit it in place. It's got rubies in it, he said. I saw it. Really? I asked him. Yes. James laughed and cried and shook with relief. I'm so glad, he said. You're my wife. At least before God, you're my wife. Oh, Nina, I'm so glad you prayed for a sign. I hope nobody can see the rings except us. They can't, James followed. He told me. Really? Yeah, we're the only ones who know they're there. And then James was on top of me again. But it was different, because I knew it was James and not Jesus. I didn't feel glowing and holy afterwards. I felt like I was made from mud. I didn't know what to do. In my bed that night and for nights afterwards, I stared up at the ceiling and prayed for a tornado to come down and suck me up and throw me in a river somewhere far away. I prayed for the ceiling to fall right in on me and flatten my face and scar me up so that nobody, not James, not Jesus, not anybody at all, would ever want to touch me again.
I had bad dreams about being whipped in front of the altar. I had bad dreams that James was whipping me, then rolling me over and being Jesus for me. Except he wasn't Jesus. He was Satan. Either Satan or Grandpa Herman. I woke up sweating and kept climbing out of bed, creeping to the bathroom where I stood before the faucet. But I couldn't even turn it on to make sure it ran water and not blood, because all I deserved was blood. But I didn't see any blood. Not anywhere. Not in the faucet, and not in the toilet after I peed. Not in my underpants, not on my sheets. No blood at all. I thought maybe the rapture had come already, and we'd all missed it. The entire fire and brimstone community. I knew I had to be living in the years of plague and revelation. There was plenty of food, but I couldn't eat. I'd seen no stinging beasts, but I jumped up for fear of them at every corner. I knew it was my fault. I'd taken something beautiful like our prayers and turned them into something horrible, just so I could keep feeling good. And I didn't feel good. Not at all. Nana said, "Honey, what's eating at you?" And I wanted to say it was a little baby Jesus eating me up from the inside, eating me like cake. But what I really said was nothing. "Something's on your heart, ain't it?" Nana asked. And I fell into her arms and cried like I'd been left behind. As she held me, I thought for sure that that'd be the last time I'd ever feel my Nana, so soft in spite of her bones. "Is it about James?" "Yes," I wailed. "He's different now. He's just growing up, child. And you are, too. I know he's spending more time with the men, but he hasn't forgotten you. That's how men are." "Can I stay here for a while?" I asked Nana. "I don't want to go home." It was a Saturday, and I was supposed to be helping Mama clean. "Yes," Nana said. "I'll run over to your house and tell Marie you're helping me with my floors. Go ahead and get the broom." So I spent the afternoon with Nana, while Mama cleaned alone and the men fished. But I couldn't talk. I cried and my nose poured so hard that I could have mopped the floor with snot. But Nana didn't make me work. She brought me a bowl of prunes instead, and each one doubled in my mouth. I didn't sleep on a single nettle. I thought about it, but then I decided that I wasn't even comfortable when I was awake, so why should I be miserable when I was asleep? I was going to hell anyway, no matter how many thorns I covered up with, so I didn't even bother. James was happier than I'd ever known him. All he wanted to do was kiss on me during prayer partners. He didn't even try to be cautious about it, because as far as he was concerned, we were husband and wife during that hour, every evening. Before, there'd been something graceful about his tentativeness, but all that was gone. Before, all he'd had to do was brush against the skin on the inside of my legs, and it was like a glorious electrocution inside. But after we had the rings that weren't even real, James seemed clumsy and forceful, and I hated it. But from time to time, I'd forget how bad things were. Sometimes when he put his mouth on just the right part of my ear, I'd think that God had been speaking to me, that maybe I wasn't making the rings up, that if James said God had given him a ring for me, then maybe it was at least partly true. Then I started wondering if maybe how you made God answer was by giving him the first part of the sentence you wanted him to say. I thought I was a liar, but I wasn't certain. One Sunday in church, sitting between Nana and James like I always did, with Grandpa Herman right in the middle of his terrible story about how Nana was a liar who had lied to God by not telling about her mama's affair with Western Ward, and an accomplice to murder because she didn't stop her daddy from being killed, I decided to speak in tongues. It wasn't something I'd been planning, and it wasn't something that God told me to do either. It just happened, all of a sudden, like a rooster that crows in the middle of the day for no apparent reason. I stood right up and spoke out. I said something like, "Lord,
Please open my heart and fill me up with your beauty and love. Lord, I'm asking you for your precious gift. In front of me, Mama and Daddy, David and Laura, Everett and Wanda, Bethany and Olin, all opened up their mouths and started praying out loud, so loud that I felt like I needed to shout, Lord, I'm here. Take me and fill me up, I said again.
Praise God,
Grandpa Herman called.
Help her, sweet Jesus, Olin yelled.
All around me I could feel a heat, and I wasn't sure if I was going to pass out or not.
Lord, I want to know you inside and out, I hollered. I want to know your Heba Mashundi Walaka Oma Heba Mashundi.
The only word I knew for sure that I'd heard people speak in tongues was Heba Mashundi, so I let that one move my lips again and again. Then I knew I was going to pass out. I was almost certain. I felt sick and weak and carried away. As far as I could tell, God wasn't leading me anywhere. I was making the words up as I went, and they seized up in my mouth and spilled like lies all over the hard wood floor.
Help me, Jesus, I tried. Help me not get caught in your Welamaka or my Heba Mashundi.
And then I began to whisper, or maybe to cry. Around the church, there was the sound of whoops and amens and clapping, and the strange words that I was making up, and everything was dark on either side of me. But right up front, where Grandpa Herman stood, beckoning me with his arms, it was bright for a second. And then that was gone too, and I was sitting back down, out of breath, convulsing inside. I couldn't look at Nana or James. I couldn't sing aloud with the congregation, though I moved my heavy tongue through the song.
Jesus can't come in until we throw old Satan out. And I want Jesus in me, 'cause that's what I'm about. So beat me till I'm weary, and whip me till I'm blue. And make a space, sweet Savior, for no one else but you.
It was the longest day in church I've ever known. I couldn't break the trance I'd induced myself. I walked around for days whispering under my breath, Heba Mashundi, Heba Mashundi. My mind was slow those days. I worked in the fields and sang with everybody else, but later I couldn't remember it. I went to supper and picked at my food, but by the time I went to bed, I couldn't recall what we'd had. I went to prayer partners with James and obliged him as much as I could, and I guess I even talked to him, though I can't imagine what I said. Ben Harback, who had recovered from his sickness, finally broke in too. He just came in mad to breakfast one morning and told Grandpa that he was sick and tired of his bullshit and that he intended to leave and tell the whole world about what fire and brimstone had done to him. Grandpa Herman ceremoniously kicked him out, and as Ben was leaving, he yelled things that made the women cover their ears. But I didn't cover mine. It didn't even shock me. And then we had a week of preachings every night after prayer partners, all titled Vitamins Against Evil, to help the rest of the congregation not fall into Satan's hands like Ben had done. I sat beside Nana each night, but I didn't talk to her. And when she put her hands on my legs to pat them during the sermons, I hardly felt it. We didn't get into our beds until long past midnight, and had to be in the fields when the sun came up, which meant we ate breakfast in the dark. I knew that I was probably having a baby, and that probably it was James's baby, and not Jesus's. But I didn't have the energy to do anything about it, to even think about it. So I didn't. Heba Mashundi, I whispered to each leaf of tobacco as I popped it off the stalk. Heba Mashundi, I mouthed to the hornworms I shook off before I tossed the tobacco onto the drags. My eyes locked into a blurry, unblinking place. When we'd finished a field, I'd stand at the edge, looking over the stripped stalks with only their tops left, and thinking that we'd made ruffles by popping the leaves away.
We'd taken the tobacco's clothes and left it with only ruffles to hide beneath. The whole time James would pray, I'd say it over and over to God. Heba Mashundi, Heba Mashundi. Like it was a password into a secret gate that I really needed to get through. At nights, I didn't talk to Jesus. I imagined him. I closed my eyes and saw him on the cross, holding azaleas for me, dying for me, bleeding for me, instead of me. And I was jealous of Jesus, who could die when things got tough. It seemed like he got a lucky break. Do you think that somebody like Ben Harback, who has sinned so terribly and so many times, can still enter the kingdom of heaven? I asked Mama one day, as we were putting clothes on the line. I was beginning to worry about my soul and my belly. I'd finally admitted that you can only stay in a trance for so long before you have to wake up and rejoin the world, before you forget how. If he does enough penance, Mama said, and if he asks Jesus to come back into his heart. You mean Jesus will leave your heart sometimes? I said, and handed her a pair of Daddy's pants. The wet clothes were draped over my arms, weighing me down so much I kept moving to keep from being planted there. Oh, yes, Mama said. Your body is a temple for the Lord, and if it gets to looking like a pigsty in there, the Lord will just find him another home. But I thought God was always with you, I said. It's a cooperative effort, Mama explained. God will always be with you, but first you have to get the conditions right. You have to invite him in and mean it. What are you worrying about this for? 'Cause I don't want Ben to go to hell just because he sinned, I claimed. Well, you worry about your soul and let Ben worry about his, okay? And then, without waiting for me to answer, she started singing The Old Rugged Cross. I didn't join in, though. I didn't even remember that I was supposed to until she turned back and said, Is something the matter, baby? No, ma'am, I promised, and began the second verse. Then I got to thinking that maybe it was Jesus's baby, because if we really hadn't been sinning and had only been knowing Jesus through each other, then it couldn't be anything but Jesus's. I counted back and discovered that the baby almost had to be planted inside of me before James and I had exchanged the invisible rings, the rings that only James and Jesus could see. If God had given a virgin a baby before, he could do it again. I thought I must be a virgin. I had to be. Because in order not to be a virgin, you either had to be married or had to be wicked. And I was halfway convinced that I wasn't either of those, even though I had a few doubts. I couldn't imagine why God would want to curse a person like me, because I worked hard and obeyed my parents and prayed and didn't sass at grown-ups hardly at all. So I decided that maybe it wasn't a curse. And then I comforted myself with the knowledge that unless a baby's supposed to stay planted in your womb, it falls out. It had happened to Laura over and over, and Grandpa said the baby had left her because of sins. So if I was really so wicked and evil, the baby would have left me, too. And I knew that I came to Mama and Daddy when they weren't even meaning to beget me, and they'd always said that I was the special child, the one God intended for them to have, even though they didn't plan it. So if I was carrying a child of my own, that had to mean that it was God's special plan, and God had surprised people before, and they'd survived. I decided I'd better tell James about it. I thought that if I made it sound like we were getting a special gift, maybe he wouldn't be upset. What? He nearly shouted. We were in the living room again, and Mama and Daddy just down the hall in the bedroom. Shh, I begged. I think I'm having Jesus's baby. What do you mean you're having Jesus's baby? I tried to act excited, but my voice jerked a little. I'm, you know, with child. Nina, you can't be. I am, I said.
Oh, shit. James, don't say that. Oh, hell, fire, and damnation, he cursed. Nina, they're gonna kill us. Even if it's Jesus's baby? I started to cry. I wanted him to put his arm around me, but he didn't. It's my baby, Nina, not Jesus's. But if I was knowing Jesus through you, then you were just the vehicle, I tried. Oh, for God's sake, Nina. I don't know what surprised me more, hearing James's reaction, or realizing that all that time, he didn't think Jesus was acting through him at all. You mean you don't think it was Jesus when we touched? No, he said. It was me and you, sinning like crazy. But even at first, it was me and you, he said again, shaking his head. The devil comes to man in the shape of a woman. I knew that. But I didn't think it'd be you. And he walked out. I sat on the doorsteps next to Mama, pulling the silks from corn. At the bottom of the steps, Daddy leaned over a bushel basket, shucking one ear after the other, yanking off the green husks and passing the naked corn to us to clean. Mama could pull off a silk without even breaking it, but I always pulled too hard, from the wrong angle, and ended up having to dig out the silks with my fingernail. As I worked, I thought about what James had said, and I fumed. I wasn't the devil. The devil wasn't inside me. I was almost sure. Daddy tossed husks to the ground, and with them the crown of silks curled up and darkened like little girl hair turned brown. I always thought of corn as female, before it was shucked. Undressed, it turned hard and regular, the kernels lined up like soldiers. Underneath, it didn't look the way I always thought it should. I didn't think I was the devil, but I wondered if beneath my skin I was so different I wouldn't even recognize myself. I hated James that night. Nobody had ever said anything so cruel to me before. And if what we'd done was a sin, then it had come from inside us both, not just me, and not because I was the woman. I studied Daddy's hands as he passed ears to me. The silks hung from his fingers like temptations that wouldn't fall away, no matter how hard he shook them. I looked at Mama's hands as she coaxed the shiny threads from between kernels, determined to remove every last clinging menace. I left silks on my ears on purpose, little secret ones that wouldn't be noticed right away. And I must have been the devil, at least a tiny bit, because I was on fire from the inside, hot and smoldering and thinking terrible things about James. I handled the corn so hard I punctured kernels with my fingers. I thought being the devil wouldn't be so bad if I could just burn James up. By the time I saw him again, I didn't feel quite the same way. He said he was sorry, but it was the weight of his hand on my thigh, the way his thumb stroked easy, that reminded me how much I loved him too. He was so scared, and I wished I was powerful enough to protect him. I wished I'd had wings like a bird so I could hide him underneath. If I was a bird, I'd peck him 5 or 6 times hard on the head and then let him under my wing. "We gotta run away," his voice quaked. "Where would we go? To the beach?" "We can't do that," I pleaded, even though a part of me wanted to race for the road. "They'd find us. We don't have any money." James wept. He started crying hard, and I hadn't seen him cry since he was little. It looked so funny, big sobs sputtering out of an almost full-size man's throat. They weren't the kind of tears people had in church, where they just fell freely and ran down faces like rain on a windshield. They were squeezed out through squinted eyes and accompanied by a sound like his lungs were colliding into one another. I didn't know what to do. It scared me for him to cry, but I tried not to let him know. Do you have any idea what they did to Ben Harback for fornicating? James asked me. Locked him in the cellar for 40 days, I told him. They did more than that. They cut him. And the reason he had to stay underground for 40 days was because he had to heal up before he could walk around again. And that day in the field, that day when he passed out, he was already sick and in pain. No, I said. It's true. And if we stay here, that's gonna be me, Nina. And he broke down again. Least you don't have a history of sin, I tried to comfort. Don't matter, he stammered. Don't make one bit of difference.
If you knew we weren't being Jesus for each other, then why'd you keep doing it?
I asked him, not accusingly, and I ran my fingers through his soft dark hair. I didn't think God would let it happen, he said. Because God was with us the whole time. I didn't know something so awful could come from something so nice. I started to tell him that it wasn't awful, but then I thought about what might happen to us. At the very least, we'd be sleeping in graves until the frost. But I was glad to know that he thought God was there, all along, right with us all that time. We'll run away, I told him. I'll come up with a plan. We can't. Yes, we can, I assured him, and I put my hands into the tops of his trousers, and that's when I felt it. Barbed wire, wrapped around him again and again. Where'd you get it? I asked him. The barn, he said. There's more in there. Come here, I said. One more time. And I pulled him to me, so that I could feel it too, the sharp wires exing into my skin, poking little holes into each of us each time he pushed. Harder, I told him. It hurts, he choked, and paused to wipe his eyes. Harder, I insisted, to know Jesus' pain. It was difficult to know for sure where all the tears were coming from. That next morning at breakfast, I couldn't eat. Just the smells of the food were too strong. Cornbread so thick and hot and oniony. I put a piece in my mouth and chewed as it got bigger. I had to swallow everything twice, and even then it didn't want to stay. James wasn't eating either. He wasn't even trying. I watched him staring at his fork, still resting beside his plate, his eyes studying it like a holy relic he couldn't imagine touching. James, you feel all right? Bethany asked him, and he looked up from the table quickly to nod. His eyes looked surprised, like somebody stung by a bee. I wondered if mine looked that way, too. In the fields that day, I figured it all out. On Thursday, when James went with the men to the tobacco auction, I'd hide between the big burlap heaps of tobacco on the back of the ton truck, and then James would distract them when they first got to the warehouse, and I'd jump off and dive under the truck until the men walked inside. I'd meet James outside the warehouse, next to the highway, and we'd run into the woods and then follow the road along until a trucker came by. We'd thumb a ride into town. We'd go to Ajita Patel's house and call Corinthian Lovell, who would help us, I was almost sure. I'd cut my hair, and she'd paint up my lips, and we'd cut off James's pants into shorts so he wouldn't be recognizable as a fire and brimstone. Then maybe she could call Ben Harback, and he'd take us to the beach an hour away, where we'd disappear. We'd get jobs in a store, or maybe as lifeguards or something. We'd find a barn somewhere and sleep there until we made some money. Or we'd call the gym teacher from school and see if she'd loan us enough money to get by for a week until we found a job. We'd find somebody who had a garden and sneak in after dark and pick tomatoes and cucumbers to eat until we could afford to buy food of our own. And later, we'd sneak back into that garden and replant it. Either that, or we'd leave them a fruit basket on their doorsteps at Christmas, anonymously.
I wondered if people at the beach planted gardens. The more I thought about it, the happier I got. We could just leave. Contrary to what anybody might think, me and James could just run away and be done with fire and brimstone forever. But it didn't happen like that. We finished filling a barn that day. In spite of the heat and stickiness that teamed up against us, we were so tired we could have skipped supper and gone straight to bed. But we didn't. I sat at the table and ate, though James only pretended to. Then, when it was time for prayer partners, I staggered out to the barn to meet James, who was tending the fires with barley and mustard. I was going to tell him about our plans if I could get him far enough away from the other boys. And even though I was scared, I was a little excited. By the time I got to the barn, I was hollering out. Then I saw mustard stretched out on a drag, and barley laying on his back on the stringer, already asleep even though it was barely dark. Barley rolled over and said, "Nina, shh." "You'll make him do all the work," I fussed. "It's his turn," Barley said. "Huh?" Mustard jumped up quick, his eyes springing open. "What?" "Go back to sleep," I told him. "It's just me." I peeked into the barn, calling James, but I didn't see him. I thought maybe he'd gone out back to wait for me at the place where we prayed when he tended fires. But he wasn't there either. "Did you find him?" Barley asked. He was up, but groggy, and walking behind me. "No," I said. "Huh," Barley pondered. "Is it late?" 9:15. "Well, he's gotta be around here. We were just talking to him not long ago. We just laid down. He can't be gone far." "Maybe he had to use the bathroom," I said, and walked back to the barn shed and waited. There were a couple of lanterns hanging from the rafters, and I stooped in the sand beneath the light, picked up a tiny stick and twiddled it in the doodlebug hole, around and around, waiting to see if the bug was at home. "If he don't come soon, I'll be your prayer partner," Barley offered. I couldn't tell if he was teasing or not. "He'll come," I said. Looking through the rickety barn door, I could see the low burners blazing orange, spread out all along the ground, heating up the tobacco inside. It was very dark except for the orange glow given off by the squat fires, and I could see the shadows of tobacco hanging from the rafters, from the wooden bars stretched from wall to wall, layered like hair. It reminded me of what hell must be like, looking into that hot door, and I wanted to back away. It was a funny feeling that shook me, one I can't exactly describe. I thought I might throw up or pass out, and so I walked away from the light and away from the barn's heat. But I tripped over a tobacco stick and stumbled into the drag where Mustard had been sleeping. "Hey, Nina, you okay?" he asked, then yawned. "Yeah, I think I got too hot," I answered, and I tried to sound ordinary, but my voice was marbled with panic. I was almost sure James had left Fire and Brimstone without me. If I couldn't be with James, I wanted to be alone, but Mustard didn't know that. He hopped down and stood with me, away from the light. "It's too hot to even breathe," he muttered. "Yeah," I agreed. "James probably snuck off to the pond to cool down." "You think so?" I asked hopefully. "He told me this morning he wanted to finish that barn early enough for us to have time to go swimming. I guess after me and Barley fell asleep, he just went on his own." "He's never done that before, and he was expecting me." "Yeah," Mustard said. "Maybe he forgot." But I knew James hadn't forgotten. He might not have wanted to see me. He might even have left me. But I knew for a fact that James hadn't forgotten me. No matter what, he wouldn't be able to do that. "Well, I'm real worried about him," I said finally. And I guess Mustard got concerned about him too, because he told Barley that we were going off to look for James and to stay awake until he got back. 10 minutes later, I was sitting behind Mustard on a horse, trotting through the woods. Mustard had the reins in one hand and a lantern in the other, but my hands were empty. Even though I could see the little branches, I didn't stop them from slapping me as they swung past Mustard. We darted in and out of trees, and I studied the moon, narrow as a claw, the stars that hung prickly above me. Though it was night, the temperature hadn't dropped much, and I was sweating. I could feel the horse sweating beneath my thighs, and I could smell the hot dampness of our bodies. My legs itched from the rough, damp rubbing. I was almost sure James wasn't swimming, and I tried to concentrate on the shadows the lantern cast, on the horse's breathing and Mustard's. I tried not to notice the fear that felt like it was hugging me too tight. In my mind, I talked to James the way I talked to Jesus, as if he was really there. "Don't leave me here," I prayed. "Just because the baby ain't in your body, don't mean you can go. Not without telling me, at least. The least you could have done is told me." I tried to convince myself that when we got to the pond, we'd find James splashing around, and we'd probably hop in the pond with him and play. I'd have to take off my dress and just swim in my underwear. I'd have to pull up my hair to keep Mama from noticing. I told myself we'd barely make it back before prayer partners were over, and I tried to feel excited and brave. But I feared that in spite of Mustard and the horse, I was already completely alone. I didn't want to live at Fire and Brimstone without James. Just before we got to the pond, I could see another light shining dim through the bushes and trees. Mustard turned the horse in that direction, looked back at me, grinned, and said, "Told you." "James?" I yelled out, happy. "Hey, James!" And I decided in just that instant that I was going to take off all my clothes and dive into the water and not worry about my hair. I'd tell Mama I went swimming instead of to prayer partners. I'd tell Mama that I prayed underwater. I decided I might even tell her about the baby. And I decided it wouldn't matter if Mustard saw me and James kissing. I decided I didn't care.
"James, you idiot!" Mustard hollered. "What would you have done if that barn had burned down?"
But nobody answered. "That's strange," I said. Mustard stopped the horse near an old broken tree that had fallen into the pond. Though the roots were still partially planted in the ground, the tree sloped down from the bank and gradually disappeared into the water. I knew the boys liked to dive from the trunk, even though they'd been warned that they could be caught on limbs underwater. So when I saw the flashlight sitting so still on the tree trunk, abandoned a few feet from the place where water swallowed the old oak, I hopped off the horse right away, climbed onto the tree, and carefully made my way towards the flashlight.
"James?"
I called out, feeling the panic rush back down to my toes and numb me all over. Mustard waved the lantern around so we could see the surface of the pond, but James wasn't there. The lantern shook as Mustard bolted towards me, sure-footed even though the tree was only a few feet wide, and the light bounced on the water with his steps, making the shadows of other trees appear to wave violently. By the time he reached me, I had already picked up the piece of rope I found running along the length of the tree and then going under beside the trunk.
"What's the rope for?" I asked. "Has this rope always been here?" "James?" he called. "James?"
And I pointed the flashlight to the land-tied end of the rope and saw that it was knotted around the roots. Then I straddled the log and pulled from the other way. I could feel the rope giving, then tightening. I caught the rope between my toes and stretched my leg into the pond as far as I could, but the rope was much longer. Then Mustard grabbed the rope behind me, and we both pulled, and Mustard told me it might just be a sunken boat, and I cried because the other end was too heavy to be the kind of boat you can float in a regular pond, and because Mustard was crying too. We pulled for a while more, but the rope was clearly hung.
"James can hold his breath for a real long time. He's even better at it than Barley,"
Mustard whispered.
Should we swim down and try to loosen it? I asked him.
Not yet, Mustard said, but his voice sounded like pleading, even though he didn't mean for it to.
So we jerked and tugged and fought more with the rope and leaned backwards until we fell, both of us, off the tree and into the water, knocking the lantern in too, and I sunk like a cinder block. I squinted my eyes shut and rose up and met Mustard dripping and clutching the tree. To my right, the lantern floated away, and the light was dim from just the flashlight, because there was no moon to speak of. But when we climbed back on and pulled again, the rope wasn't caught anymore. I passed it back to Mustard, grabbing handful after handful of wet rope, and it wasn't as slippery as I thought rope should be, or as light. Finally, we pulled a massive piece of tree out of the water, and as it surfaced, I could see a body tied to it. "Get the flashlight," I told Mustard. "It might not be him." But it was James. James and a big chunk of tree tied together like twins joined at the side. The rope was wrapped and knotted around his waist, and then knotted around the middle of the waterlogged tree. They were so twisted together that it looked like they'd grown that way, and a branch thinned narrow in four or five directions over his head. I stood on the trunk looking down at James, his mouth gaping, and the water captured in my dress dripped down on him. I was suddenly cold and suddenly still, and I didn't hear Mustard say, "Give me the rope," until he'd already pulled it from my hands. We towed him to the edge of the pond, and then Mustard heaved him onto the grass. I stayed on the bank with James while Mustard rowed back to get help. I didn't untie him from the thick piece of tree, or wipe away the algae draped over his ear and neck. I didn't touch him. I held the flashlight on him and studied the way he'd wrapped himself in rope and wood. I wondered if he'd known he would smell like a plant, so fibery, when he was pulled from the pond. I wondered what the rope was for. If he'd worried that no one would find him and he'd sink to the bottom, or if he worried that without it, he might change his mind. I imagined him fastening that knot around his waist, so tight it looked elastic around his thin middle. I imagined him swimming down, feeling for the thickest branch. I wondered if he'd died tying knots. I wondered how long it took his lungs to fill. I held the rope in my hands and watched him, framed with cattails and reeds. And later, when I heard voices shouting, voices screaming out as they came towards the pond, the sounds seemed so far away, like how voices from hell must sound to God, so forgettable. I'm not sure who cut the rope from his body or who cut the rope from the tree, but when Daddy led me home, I still had it in my hands, twisted around and around. Some people say you can't change history, but that isn't entirely true. We did it at Fire and Brimstone, and it was easy. James didn't take his own life. He drowned on a hot night, caught on a root in the bottom of the pond. Nobody ever mentioned that he was tethered to that sunken tree with thick, deliberate knots. And that was that. At his funeral, with everybody crying and howling so, nobody even blinked when Grandpa Herman said his death was accidental. Nobody minded that he praised James and talked about what a good companion he'd make for the angels. That's what we wanted to hear. Pammy couldn't stop shaking. She shook for the rest of that summer, and the only thing that made her stop was sitting between my legs and letting me practice on her hair. I learned French braiding after James died. I worked on Pammy's red hair until it looked like something out of a magazine. And even though in the past the adults wouldn't have let us wear our hair in fancy braids, nobody seemed to notice or to care. Mustard and Barley had a fight and didn't talk to each other for nearly a month. Even though Grandpa Herman made them pray together and hug, they went their separate ways afterwards. Barley stayed in the woods as much as he could, and Mustard just stomped around, his head hung down to hide his strange eyes. I didn't do much of anything, except keep watch over everybody else and study their mouths,
the way they dropped down a little more than before. I listened to the quiet. It was quiet all the time. And sometimes when I'd think that things had gotten too quiet, I'd strain my ears and hear sounds that must have been there all along. Voices whispering, sewing machines buzzing, tractors thumping across the holes in dirt roads. Every time I went into Bethany and Olin's house, Bethany grabbed hold of me and cried. But I didn't have any tears to share. I'd just stand there like a post, being something for Bethany to cling to. I went into James's bedroom right afterwards and sifted through his drawers without asking. I took one of his flannel shirts and wore it all the time, even though it was still summer. When I buttoned it over my dress, it bagged down like my heart, and I liked the way it looked and wouldn't take it off. It had a little bit of smell left in it, and I promised myself that I wouldn't forget that smell. It was only a couple of weeks after James died that school started again, and even though Mama tried to get me to take off James's shirt, I wouldn't. I wore it every day, and if anybody made fun of me, I don't remember it. "Get that thing off and let me wash it," Nana tried. "No, ma'am," I said. "I don't want to be without it." "You can put it right back on." "It's not that dirty," I claimed. But it was dirty. It was stained with food I'd spilled, though I hardly ever spilled food before, and it had grease all along one arm from helping Daddy work on a tiller. "How about if you put on another one of James's shirts? Will you do that? Just until I get this one washed. It's starting to carry an odor, Nina." So I agreed. Nana walked over to Bethany and Olin's to get the clean shirt. I stayed on her couch, and when she handed it to me, I took it to the bathroom to change, even though I had on a perfectly good dress beneath it. I was too big to sit in Nana's lap, way too big. But when she settled in her rocking chair, I went and sat with her, slinging my long legs over the side so it wouldn't put too much weight on her brittle bones. "My old girl," Nana said, and patted my back. "Tell me a story," I begged her. "I'm tired," Nana said. "I've been working all day, and all you've been doing since you got home from school is moping around. You tell me a story." I laughed. "What story do you want to hear?" "How about the story of the day before James died?" she whispered. "Why do you want to hear about that?" I said, trying to sound normal, but hearing my voice scratching up towards despair. "Because it's a story I believe you need to tell," she answered. And I almost told her. I wanted to tell her. But there was so much that came before the words, so much sadness, and it was like my breath was racing down a big flight of stairs, letting itself out one step at a time. Then just when I'd get to the bottom and think I was going to be okay, I'd steal my breath back in one big gulp and start leaping down again until it was all out of me. "I'll tell you a story," Nana said while I cried. "I'll tell you about Liston and Marie Huff. You ever heard of them? They're good people. Live out in the country with their family. God-fearing, soul-searching people. The kind of people you'd want to be with, except when something goes bad. Because when things go bad, Liston and Marie turn into measuring cups. You know what I mean?" "No," I wheezed. "Measuring cup people always think about quantity. Half a pound of this or a whole cup of that. And for grief, you only get so much. Just like you only get so much happiness or so much sickness. They ain't particularly stingy with it, but they just figure half a cup ought to be enough for everybody. So when they're mixing up their cake, they put in just the right amount. And if it comes out not tasting sweet enough for you, then the problem ain't their lack of honey. It's your sweet tooth. But the truth is that the cake might not be sweet enough for them either. And if that's the case, they shovel in forkfuls of bad cake and think about candy while they're eating it. And pretend." Everybody's worried about you, baby, Nana said. They just don't know what to do for you. Your mama and daddy think that if they ignore it, it will go away. All the pain you got in your little heart. They figure that if they don't mention it, then you won't have to feel it. And they don't want to remind you of the thing that makes you hurt. I loved him, Nana, I told her. I know, dear. No, it was special, I tried. Of course it was, and he loved you too. Do you know what we did? We let Jesus speak through us. We prayed that Jesus would show us his love through the other person, and it worked. Nana rocked me on and on, patting me almost too hard and letting me stay there even though I must have been hurting her with my weight. I was so tall by then. Do you have any idea what made that boy want to leave this world? She asked me finally. No, I lied, and started whimpering again. That's okay, Nana consoled. You can tell me about it later, if you feel like it. She was just at home with lies, as she was with the truth. For that, I was grateful. But the shirt didn't smell the same after Nana washed it, so I kept the other one on. I'm sorry about your friend, James, Ajita Patel told me one day, when we were supposed to be dressing out for gym. Raj told me that he died this summer, she added awkwardly. That must have been really hard. Yeah, I said, privately cursing my eyes